But water, there's no life. We can't survive. So we really appreciate this good weather. Other colleagues are still on the way, but I think we should proceed with our meeting.
You are all welcome.
And I would like to take this opportunity to invite the department to start briefing the committee. DG, you can start with the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
But DG could start. I see we have a new member, Honorable Van Dam. You are most welcome, ma'am. And we hope you'll engage us constructively as you always do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My name is Tipiko Matula. I'm the Director General of Public Enterprises. I'm going to share the presentation with one of my deputy directors general, Ms. Okolo Lampiti. I will just do a brief introduction, and then she will detail out the presentation. She's a specialist in this area of our work. We come into this presentation from the perspective that state-owned companies are vehicles of delivery of key outcomes in the sectors in which they operate. And because they're largely commercial enterprises, these are economic outcomes as such. They're outcomes that are intended to sustain the growth of the economy so that government can achieve our overarching objectives for the economy, which is growth, employment, investment, and thereby enable us to deal with the challenges of poverty and inequality in our society. So that's the broad strategic perspective that we adopt to state-owned companies. They are vehicles of delivery. In that context, therefore, the shareholder compact is a very, very important instrument. It's an instrument that the government, the department, uses to direct the companies to monitor what they do, to control, if necessary, their activities, and to enforce accountability. So the shareholder compact is a very, very fundamental document to manage the relationship between the state and these entities, as it were. And it has evolved over time as an instrument. I think that if I were just to speak for the department, and you will see in the detail of the presentation, that we have this instrument pretty much under control. We struggle sometimes with regard to finalizing it, the negotiations that go into it, and so on. But at the end of the day, we do get these contacts concluded with the companies. That is a very important compliance issue. It's a fundamental compliance issue. It's audited by the Auditor General, and you know that we, as a department, have a track record of clean audits. I'm pleased to say this year we have restored after a regression last year. We have restored our clean audit track record. So the Auditor General also looks at this thing, because this is the core business of the department, the oversight of state-owned companies. But we very much spend, for that reason, it's an internal tool, it's an internal management tool in our work as a department. It is governed by the statute, it is governed by the PSMA, and Ms. Mahulu will will give some more details in that regard. Chairperson, I understand that the point of the engagement is how we bring ourselves by the way in which Parliament can influence the shareholder compact, as it were. And I'd like to just give a perspective in that regard, because the state-owned companies are subject to oversight by the executive authority, a executive authority who derives the mandate from Parliament. The mandate of executive authorities is fundamentally derived from Parliament. When it comes to the oversight of companies who are in the implementation sphere, we're pretty much in the operational sphere with regard to the mandate that Parliament gives to the executive authority. And that mandate will spell out the desired outcomes. And I think that in terms of our portfolio, the desired outcomes are clear. Because eventually also Parliament votes on the budget for the execution of that mandate. That mandate establishes the responsibility of the executive authority to direct the department accordingly. And then, by extension, to compact with the state-owned company as vehicles of delivery. So that is one major dimension through which Parliament influences the shareholder compact. We cascade, well, it's possible for cascading the mandate into the shareholder compact in a very broad terms. However, the companies have the responsibility, once they have performed and executed the deliverables that are included in the compact, they have a responsibility to report to Parliament. So they have an obligation to table their annual report, and Parliament at that level is also able to engage with the work of the companies and to comment, criticize, and provide guidance as may be the case. We, as a department, are also subject to your oversight, so we get called to report on an ongoing basis. I would say that once the shareholder compact is concluded, the CFMA also requires the companies to report on a quarterly basis, and so we're able to monitor whether they are on track in regard to implementing the deliverables that are commissioned upon. The two major statutes that apply in this area are the PMA and the Competition Act. With that brief background, I will hand over to my colleague, the Deputy Director General, who will try and take us into the detail of the presentation. And we'll take questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and morning to committee members and colleagues. Chair, the DG has given an outline really of what the presentation will be covering for the morning. I think it's also important with the background to indicate that as a department, we want to foster a culture of accountability. And this stems really from the excellent internal controls that we have exhibited. And to that regard, as the DG has also indicated, that the Auditor General has been able to confirm this through a sustained clean audit over a period of years. And we want our state-owned companies, therefore, to also exhibit the same conduct. The next slide, Chair, is just to give a broad outline of the legislative and policy context within which the shareholder compact is being developed. A compact really is an annual agreement between the minister as the executive authority and the board of a state-owned company. And we use it as a performance monitoring tool because it's also a legislative requirement. And as we develop them, we are also mindful of the fact that it becomes a challenge because we do so within a very fragmented legal and regulatory environment because state-owned companies, they have a dual mandate and they are also expected to account in terms of the Companies Act. So in developing the compact, it is important. It is also important to ensure that we define key objectives for performance measures and the targets. And in so much as we want to look at financial sustainability, operational and socio-economic performance, we are clear also that there is a need for a paradigm shift for state-owned companies to look beyond a triple bottom line. And therefore, you'll see as we go through the presentation that we also have included socio-economic performance measures which are aimed at developing the communities within which the SOCs operate. One of the tools that we have developed as a department is a logical planning and monitoring evaluation framework. And really in developing these tools, it was also to ensure that we sharpen our stakeholder oversight role. And as I said earlier on, that because state-owned companies operate within fragmented legal environment, we needed to direct them in terms of trying to harmonize legislations that apply to companies. In the negotiation of contract, we normally want to ensure that the state-owned companies are also able to acknowledge wider government objectives and therefore take into account a number of policy imperatives. It is therefore important that we start with the intergovernmental consultations to make sure that their operations are aligned with other wider government objectives. And this requires consultation with policy departments, national treasury, and the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation in the presidency. Once those engagements concluded, we are able therefore to develop what we call a strategic intent statement. And this is really ministers' access to the companies, and it is aimed at qualifying the shareholder expectations and to eliminate the elements of surprises as the state-owned companies develop their plans. So the strategic intent statement is given to the company by the minister on annual basis, and on the basis of the key principles contained in the statement, we are able, therefore, to start engaging in the shareholder compact negotiations with state-owned companies. The negotiations of the shareholder compact as well, because it's an annual contract, it's premised on the content and format which is not adequately articulated in the Public Finance Management Act, the PFMA. So we needed, therefore, to qualify the elements we would be able to drive the state-owned companies' businesses and at the same time making sure that there's consistency in the manner in which they report. So we will also engage with national treasury in some of the areas, especially issues that related to financial sustainability, budgeting, and borrowing plans of the state-owned companies. Once the shareholder contract is negotiated, concluded, it will be then signed off from the department side by the minister, and from the company side it will be signed off by the board. And therefore, on the basis of the compact, the state-owned companies, they go and plan on a longer-term basis, and they develop a corporate plan. Now, the questions that we've been asked in the past was, given the fact that state-owned companies, they are engaged in long-term build programs, and which are long-lead investments, why would you have a shareholder compact, which is a performance contract, on an annual basis? And the question, the reason for this is that, other than the fact that it's a legislative requirement, but also that given the fact that the state-owned companies operate within an environment that evolves all the time, there's a lot of external factors that affect their businesses. So we need to be agile in the manner in which we monitor them. So doing an annual contract allows us the flexibility of engaging with state-owned companies, unlike relying on a corporate plan, which is only a long-term document.
So on the basis of their corporate plans, legal companies will deliver their long-term plans over a period of 5 years, their budgeting, and they will be able to indicate those that will be able to be delivered on an annual basis. Then the corporate plan is submitted, again, it's a statutory requirement, then of FEB on annual basis, and also to the department and to the National Treasury. And on the basis of corporate plan, we are able, therefore, to engage in the performance monitoring through quarterly reports. And we have developed a system in the department called the dashboard because it allows us a quick overview over the plans of the state-owned company. So we collect information based on this, the annual and the five-year plan. And we are able to then communicate on a quarterly basis through an investor brief, where Minister provides constant feedback to the companies on areas of concern, and where we notice deviations, we are able to raise those issues with the state-owned companies in time. Then this performance monitoring of quarterly reports leads therefore to an annual general meeting with state-owned companies, where therefore they need to table their annual reports to the Minister, put the number of resolutions for Minister to consider and adopt, and also allow the Minister to express a view before tabling those annual reports to Parliament as required in terms of Section 65. And also because the annual general meeting is a requirement in terms of the Companies Act, we needed to make sure that our AGM cycle takes place between June and September of every year, so that we are able also to engage with external stakeholders for state-owned companies and interested parties. The next slide, Chair, is just to give a broad overview of the policies that define the national economic development priorities. Again, this is pretty much on the basis that state-owned companies, they cannot act outside broader government policies. And there's a number of policies that affect the state-owned companies, from the medium-term strategic framework, the new development plan, the new growth path, the industrial policy action plan. And in addition, there are other policies that are sector-related, for example, your BBB codes, gender policies, youth development policies, and also policies that ensure that the state-owned companies contribute to the direct foreign investment, and so that to catalyze the environment for development. And also there are those that are regional policies, your SADC, the continental policies such as for development of network initiatives, as well as for BRICS, because again we acknowledge that South Africa is a part of the global community, and therefore state-owned companies have a role in assisting governments in those activities. And in developing the shareholder compact, we therefore are mindful of the fact that we need to take all of these policies into account. However, there are those salient features that we would put on top, and those include all initiatives that ensure that state-owned companies contribute to job creation through their labor absorption capacity, and also to ensure that they contribute to proper procurement, because we all acknowledge that government and its institutions is one of the largest spenders of goods and services, and therefore we want to ensure that as state-owned companies procure, they do so also to develop small businesses and also contribute to the development of local suppliers. I think this night, Chair, we just decided to put it in really to strengthen our belief that state-owned companies have a dual mandate to make sure that they operate commercially, they are sustainable, they reduce their reliance on the fiscal, but at the same time they become catalyst for development. And our view is that you need key drivers of development, and if we believe that there's four key issues that state-owned companies should contribute to, is to ensure that they drive investment, they contribute to transformation of the economy, skills development in the country that does not nurture its skills, will find itself being exposed in terms of how it interacts with the global communities, and also regional development, because you also need to develop communities and those that are marginalized. So with those key drivers, we therefore believe that state-owned companies will be able to increase their competitiveness in the economy, but we need also to make sure that in doing so, they don't only invest for themselves, but they also invest for other industries so that they provide additional capacity, but also they also develop the infrastructure. And to this end, all this ESCOM and Transnet and also in Zimbabwe, they participate in the SIP program, where they are part of the peer program of the PIDC. And we also ensure that they unlock investment in supplier industries, and I think the community is also aware of a number of initiatives that the department and the state-owned companies are involved in terms of supplier development, and also to make sure that they not only, as I said, invest for themselves, but for the product economy. Then the question is, how do we engage in developing the targets? We have a process in the department that we agreed upon with the state-owned company. First and foremost, as I said, we take into account the policy context and to make sure that we constantly monitor and evaluate the policy shift in the country from a country perspective. And this is important, especially in light of the fact that South Africa adopted a developmental agenda, and therefore, as the policy change, we needed to take that into account. And once we've done that, we engage into benchmark exercises. And in this case, we look at the ability of the state-owned companies to partner with the private sector, and at the same time, to be able to grow the economy regionally. And in doing this benchmark exercises, we are able to ensure that because state-owned companies are not private sector companies, but they also compete for skills and resources alongside the private sector companies. It is therefore important that they also play a role where they are able to fertilize the environment for private sector participation. So our benchmarks, they also look in terms of what other companies are doing and how they can also support the state-owned companies. And then with that, we develop a baseline, which would be a minimum starting point for our comparison, and then we engage the own companies into key performance areas based on different levers. The content of the shareholder context check, briefly, we've just given an example of mandate, because again, our portfolio is very fragmented, from in energy to ports, freight, aviation, and mining, defense, and forestry. So we have to make sure that the mandate that we articulate to the state-owned companies are aligned to what is in their boundary legislation. And once we've done that, we are therefore able to provide the strategic objectives for the country. So this slide is basically just an example of mandates, various mandates for state-owned companies. Transportation of passenger, cargo, and mail, in most cases, this is our aviation portfolio. And also diversification and growing of customer base, and this will be more in the case of Port Bend in Fargo. I think this is one of the most important slides, if I may say, because it's again just a quick dashboard analysis of the performance of our state-owned company for the period 2013-14. And we use this here because we believe that it is important to look at the performance of the state-owned companies from a portfolio point of view. So you would see that within this period, We have three state-owned companies that are on EMBA, and this is Transnet, Portbet Infarco, and Safcon. They did not achieve in terms of what was contained in the compact, but they are on a way to recovery. And you see, then we've got two state-owned companies that are doing very well. Dinel being able to achieve 88% of its targets, and Alisco that achieved 94% of its targets, despite challenges with the implementation and of the deed of settlement, which is very onerous on the company. Then we've got, of course, three companies that are really challenged, and this is our emission portfolio, SAA and South African Express, as well as Eskom. And I think the challenges with these three state-owned companies talks to, again, the environment in which they operate. When you look at the aviation portfolio, there are main exogenous factors that affect their operations, from the increasing oil prices that affect their ability to procure jet fuel and at reasonable cost, as well as just the challenged environment of aviation globally. And Eskom, I think the committee is familiar with the challenges that are facing security of supply, as well as the constraint grid, and therefore the department through the interministerial committee, they are working with the company and to try to address these challenges. DG alluded to some of the challenges in the development of shareholder compact, and I think here we felt that it is important as well that we have the committee that we made good strides in developing compact and agreeing, aligning the targets with the policy imperatives, the discussions with the policy department, national treasury. But we still have challenges in terms of ensuring alignment of those targets with the executive performance, and in this case in particular the remuneration and the benefits of executive managers. And another challenge is that we found that it is at times there are too many targets, and in this case both from the department and also from the entities themselves. So we are mindful of the fact that therefore we need to provide a balance between the targets that the so-called soft targets or socio-economic targets vis-a-vis the financial sustainability and operational targets. And we've come to a point where we realize that because stable companies in our portfolio, they operate in various sectors and industries, in developing targets we need also to take into account the factors that affect their ability to deliver on those targets. This is alluded to a delays in negotiation process. We have introduced a system where at the technical level, once the compact has been agreed, the principles are agreed between the department and the minister, and it's open for negotiations. The technical teams between the state owned companies and the department have a period of 2 months to negotiate. And within that period, if the executives and officials are not able to agree on the nature of the compact or the key performance indicators, the negotiations are escalated to the chief executive level and the director general. And in the event the challenges there, they will be escalated to the minister and the chairman of the board. Fortunately enough, we have been able to negotiate, and we have not been able to escalate. We have never had a situation where we escalate to the minister, but we have escalated to the DG and the CE. And at that level, we've been able to agree on the compact. One of the challenges again is balancing the achievement of the developmental objectives, again as we said, because they don't companies have a dual mandate, and also how do we ensure that the developmental mandate does not constrain the financial sustainability of the companies. And we see challenges with the punitive measures for non-performance, and again this is in light of the constraints that are in the Labour Relations Act on the provisions of executive conditions of service, and I get it, acknowledging the delineation of roles between the department with the minister and the chief executives and the board. And therefore, we have introduced new performance measures that are taking into account the labor conditions and the provisions of the Labor Relations Act. And also in doing this, we have introduced some guidelines through the quarterly reporting framework for state-owned companies. Then, just to give the committee a feel of the interventions that we have introduced in the challenges that we just highlighted. We have introduced the remuneration standards, which were tabled to cabinet, and the cabinet requested that the process for finalization be delayed, because at the time when we tabled, it was just at the time when we were looking forward to the new administration. So we will be taking the final remuneration standards to cabinet soon. But with the remuneration standards, the aim is to align the executive pay with the company performance. Again, we want to foster the culture of incentives that are linked to company performance. So the idea is to ensure that once the shareholder compact is concluded between the minister and the board, the board is able to cascade down to the chief executive and the chief financial officer. And then the chief executive officer and the CFO will have to cascade it down further to EXCO. And in that way, then you are able to monitor the performance of the company, and you are able, therefore, to align it to the payment of incentives and bonuses at the right time. We also introduced the amended quarterly reporting guidelines, and again, is to also enhance our oversight on the implementation of the number of projects for state-owned companies. And we ensure that quarterly reports are submitted in the department in time, that we are able to upload the information into the dashboard so that it gets fixed from in terms of performance of the state-owned companies. We have also continued on ensuring that the regular engagements between the minister, the office of the Auditor General, the chairpersons and CEOs of state-owned companies. And again, this is to deal with issues without surprise, because then if there are issues that we're picking up during quarterly reporting and for the investor, the minister is able to engage openly and frankly with the chairpersons and CEOs. And again, it's also to foster the culture of the portfolio performance, because therefore all the SOCs are able to see how we are performing as a portfolio. One major initiative is a couple of years ago, the department developed the government shareholder management legislation, which we took to cabinet. And this really came at the backdrop of understanding the evolution of the department. The Department of Public Enterprises was started as an office of privatization. So the intent was that we are going to be an arrangement for 2 or 5 years, and the state-owned companies in our portfolio would be privatized, and that was in between 1994 and 1998. However, there was a policy shift that we needed to retain the state-owned companies, because there was an acknowledgement that they can play critical and fundamental role in the development of the economy. However, with that happening, there was no proper alignment of this office of privatization, which is now becoming a department, and therefore there was no clear mandate that was given to the Department of Public Enterprises through legislation or proclamation. And we find ourselves developing our mandate through the other legislations, such as the PFMA or the other legislations regulating the state-owned companies, like your policy or sector legislation. And also what was challenging for us was the fact that state-owned companies themselves are established by their own legislation. So they put legislations that give them and their board powers, and in those legislations the power of a shareholder is limited. So we found ourselves in a space where our ability to be able to influence and direct their operations was constrained. And we developed this government shareholder management legislation as a tool, therefore, firstly, to enhance our shareholder function, but also to provide strategic intervention by the minister as and when is required. and also to ensure that the mandate of the state-owned companies are now crystallized in terms of the developmental aspects as well as the their financial sustainability. And the Act was also intended to create a number of trade-offs between the activities of the state-owned companies and where they would be able to require funding from the fiscus. So the process is we will be tabling this legislation during this financial year, and we hope we'll be able to take the process further through a parliamentary process. And I think DG did ask at some point that time permitting, schedule permitting, the department should come and present the details of the system legislation to the committee. The next slide is just to give the committee then a feel of where we are with the compacts. As you see, 2013-14, all the compacts are signed and sealed. We always want to be a year ahead, and I am glad to say we've managed with the 2014-15 compacts to have all the negotiations finalized. With the SAA, we are just the final stages of those negotiations. With SAFCOL, we are awaiting the signature by the acting chair, and this delay is as a result of the transitional arrangements because the chairperson resigned the last AGM, and therefore we needed to give the new chairperson the opportunity to sign off. And with preventing SAFCOL, the compact is really approved from Mesa side, but we've also delayed finalization due to traditional arrangement again, as committees are aware that Broadband in SACO will be migrating to the Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services soon. In conclusion, Chair, we believe that there's still room to enhance the shareholder cooperative process. It is not where we want it to be, but also we believe that we have made good strides. State-owned companies are also beginning to see it as a tool that is not only aimed at monitoring them, but also ensuring that we provide transparency to the public in terms of the activities of the state-owned companies. We continue to monitor their performance, and our main focus in this regard is to improve their accountability. And we believe that we can only achieve this goal really by providing solid monitoring and evaluation systems, and again, those underpinned by the culture of delivery. And as I said, we believe that the development of the shareholder management bill is going to give us a legislative framework that would enhance our oversight. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DDG. Honourable members, that's the presentation. I would like to open up for discussions, but before discussions, let's allow questions for clarity before we can engage with the presentation. The floor is open for questions and clarity seeking. Honourable Mullen.
Thank you.
Followed by Honourable Ranto.
I need a comment down at the mic. It's excellent that we have compacts now on the table, but it's always the word is what you say, implementation, and then the oversight role that we committee have to play to follow up on the implementation and the results to see if it's really having impact, to put it that way. So that's the remark I want to make. So today is the 20th of August, so it would be interesting that we can set a time frame that we as a standing committee can have oversight on this specific aspect within 6 months or within 12 months. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Mare. Melanie,
thanks, Chairperson. My apologies for arriving late in the meeting. The information that I have in hand. Chair, I just want to check with the department the issue of the FOCs that might look incompatible or
are sometimes not accounting on their work and what is expected from them. Maybe. I am saying maybe. Is there no lack of competent people in those offices? Also, what the Department of Public Enterprises, does it have a relationship with the Department of Education, Higher Education, in ensuring that in those SOCs there will be in the near future, because we cannot run away from the fact that we are coming from a very terrible background, and we did not have, some of us do not have skills up to this moment. So there is a lack of skill development or a lack of skill within people that are put, that are employed sometimes in those places. Do you have a relationship in helping those resources to develop? And also, Chairperson, the next question is about the compact that the department has with the SOCs, signed by the SOCs. There is a trend, as the honourable member from my left hand side from the PA said, the contracts there is a lack of implementation sometimes in some other things. The contract, which I think the contract state is clear that what is expected from ESCOM, SAFCOL, and all those SOCs. Does the contract clearly indicate on penalties that will be implemented if an SOC does not reach its target, maybe by 51 or something percent or 50%, is there any line in the contract that will show that say to the embassies, if you don't reach 90% of your target or 85% of your target, knowing that the other targets are unreachable because of the fact that of external factors or factors that are not really made by that SOC. So do you have that in your contract, or is just an open contract where people are allowed to do whatever they want to do? Because at the end of the day, every person in your work that you are doing, there is accountability that is needed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Ranto, Honorable Marapela, and Honorable Teddy.
Thank you, sir, President. Mine is on the punitive measures for non-performance. I think I just want to link it with the issue around the government shareholder management bill. The understanding that I get from the presenter is that because of Labor Relations Act, maybe I might be very much subjective in my input, but I think one of the causes of the punitive plan, it might be as a result of the very same process that we're intending to engage on a government shareholder management bill, which will also capacitate or strengthen the department itself to be able to monitor the state-owned companies properly. So that we did away with the very same problem of the clear punitive measures. Then the Labor Relations Act, I think in terms of non-performance, the Labor Relations Act seems to be very much clear on what actions, course of actions that should be taken in an event that somebody a worker, for an example, if I may go to that extent, what action should actually be taken? Maybe it was going to help if the presenter could just go into detail, not just limit yourself to the Labor Relations Act. You may find that, let's make a classical example. We know that we do people are station by now, it will have been finished. And we know that once you don't finish it well, it is part of non-performance. One of the other big factors, it might be non-performance or some other factors that are affecting the project not to be completed well in time. I would have thought that the presenter will just go deeper into the issue. The last point that I'm just interested in, I think in the last two meetings, we have actually expressed a view in terms of the shareholder compact with regard to the support of small businesses, so that we need to put we suggested that the clause must be in the compact, particularly to small businesses and the development. What is it that we need to do? Because it's at 8% or whatever, so that can be very much clear on the mandate of the state-owned companies when coming to the development or support of small businesses. I'm just interested whether that thing has been able to be factored in now that the shareholder compact is at the final stages. Yeah, let me put the thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Bakela. Can we get Honorable Sadie? Follow him.
The shareholder management piece, maybe because the presenter says there is an intention to come and share what is entailing the deal with the committee before it is finalized. So I'd like to know at what stage is the deal, so that we know if there are other inputs that the committee might want to make. Were able to make those inputs before it goes very, very far. Secondly, I'm looking at the slide that talks to the performance of the SOCs, all of them, what we call the dashboard. And I've always been asking myself, why is to that kind of a situation gives a regular monitoring of these SOCs, leading to that kind of a situation where SOCs are not able to perform as expected. The presenter says on quarterly basis are able to check and track if there is any progress, if there are challenges and the like. But the situation surely is not I'm not thinking about that kind of a situation. So now that we need to do something in that regard. Because I know we have, as the committee, we have interacted with ESCO, perhaps the chair, there might also be a need to also try and interact with some of the entities, just to try and get a feel of the challenges that are, that the resources, those resources are filled with, so that we are able to make the necessary intervention. Secondly, that there is an issue of the delays in the signing of the compacts. What leads to these delays? Because surely those delays have an impact or effect in the situation that we are faced with regard to the performance of the SOEs, SSC, on the slide that I spoke about earlier on. The consequences for non-performance, I know the intention of withholding bonuses for the executives, because in other instances you have been people at very lower levels have been punished for things that they are not necessarily responsible for, when the executives are supposed to account for things that did not go well in the process. I'm happy with that kind of a situation. I know there have been some executives have been getting bonuses when the process did not perform, when people at very lower levels has been planned unnecessarily. So I'm saying that if that we might want to look at going forward. Because to me, if the nurses did not perform, punishment should start at that level. Not necessarily looking at people at the lower level. And then thirdly, the might also, this one will obviously be an input here. But perhaps on a regular basis, I thought it's an issue that the department is also looking at to try and see if there can be a session for some of these entities that are performing well to come and share best practices in terms of how best can we improve in the kind of work that we are doing. We have that kind of a situation with some of them, even those that are not necessarily accounting to the department, just to come and share best practices so that we are able to improve in the kind of work that we are doing. Can we be briefed at the committee chapter in terms of that kind of a setup? If it is there, if it is not there, I will definitely suggest that we try and come up with a mechanism for such thing to happen. But if over and above the stage that I spoke about of the shareholder management, the rest of the level of the committee who might at the end of this meeting agree on when can the department come back as a matter of agent and share the bill with the committee before the bill is taken through the other process.
Thanks, Honorable Teddy. Honorable Fanda.
At opening chairperson, at thank you, Chairperson. I'd also like to congratulate the department for having concluded the shareholder compacts. It's great to see that the clear performance targets that have been set for SOC. I was just saying I'd like to congratulate the department once again for having concluded these shareholder compacts. It's great to see that clear set performance targets have been set for SRCs, and we hope that the executives will be kept accountable to these. I think that in order for the committee to also perform its oversight role, it's important that the committee also sees these shareholder compacts. So my question is, will these shareholder compacts be brought to the committee for scrutiny?
Thank you very much for those questions. My question is relating to the SGM, the shareholder management legislation. How soon or how quick will the department be able to go through those processes? It is important because I think for us the key to the whole oversight and able to hold the SOEs, boards and executive accountable, we need to process this bill as soon as yesterday. And also it will also assist us and the department to be able to determine the remunerations of the executives and also the board itself. Because, you remember the main issue as public representation is people on the ground are saying these boards are earning a lot of money, the executives are earning a lot of money, but we don't see there's no value for money for what they are doing vis-a-vis their performance. And the department is now tight hands because they can't able to monitor or to determine the remunerations as these are labor-related issues and so on. And the bill is important because as soon as we are able to do this, can we be given the time frame for the processes to conclude all this legislation?
Okay, thank you very much, members, Chairperson, for the questions. We will share the responses between myself and the DG. I'd like to deal with the question that seems to come across all the questions that have been raised about consequences management, we would call it consequence management or non-performance. And to say that in some ways I think it's tied up with clarifying the legislation that governs state-owned companies as such. So this GFM bill will probably help in establishing that, because as one honourable member indicated, performance at work is governed by the Labour Relations Act. So the Labour Relations Act within a company will deal with those issues. Where we don't have a legal instrument is between the department, in other words, the shareholder, and the company. Other than, as often happens in US extreme cases, the shareholder has the right to dismiss the board. If the board is a company that is overseen by a board, the board that's appointed by the shareholder does not perform. And the shareholder is of the view that that non-performance has got to do with the oversight of the board. Then the recourse that the shareholder has is to remove an non-performing board and perform the board. But it's very complex, because sometimes non-performance, non-achievement of target is because of factors that are beyond the company. So in dealing with this issue, we have to exercise judgment as to what are the factors that led to non-performance. I'll give you an example in the area of Transnet. So we have a target, a Transnet must move particular volume. There's a volume target that has been set for a particular performance zero for volume. But because of the downturn in the economy, because of reduced overall production in the economy, it means that there are less volumes of goods that are available to be moved by Transnet. So in this context, it's not because they don't have the locomotives on time or trains are not arriving and on time, as it were. It's because there is just reduced volume due to the performance of the economy. So that's why the performance of the economy impacts very directly to on the performance of the company, as it were. Another example is, let's say, hey, when the economy goes down, people don't travel as much. There are fewer passengers for SAA to take. Now we've got to exercise judgment and say, in this case, we isolate that. But even if you do that, for performance, for non-performance related to, let's say, people sleeping on their jobs, as it were, within a company, the only recourse shareholder has really is to remove the board. Within the company itself, labor relations applies, and so we would expect, of course, when we have insight into that, we will prevail upon the company to make sure that non-performing managers face consequences, and the Labor Relations Act provides for that. And sometimes, you know, I mean, my performance contract, by the way, the application of the Labor Relations Act is implicit in my performance contract. It does not say, if you don't perform, you're going to be fired. It doesn't say that. But I know that. I know that if I don't perform in accordance with what I've said, you know, I should be fired. I think that's accepted. I think the law is here. In that regard, I thought I should deal with that question, but my critic will probably add, because she has applied
that she advises the department on these matters whenever we these issues arise. And I'll come back and maybe deal with some of the issues, but let me deal with the bill and the process around the bill. We withheld even the bill. The bill is pretty much developed several years ago, in fact, and we were stalled by the fact that there was other legislation that deals with more extreme issues also being contemplated at the time. I think the Treasury was contemplating amending the VFMA Act. The Department of Trade and Industry was finalizing the Companies Act, also dealing with similar issues, and then this Act. And at that point, the Cabinet had decided that, look, we should rationalize these things. You can't have great legislation or doing the same thing. And that's how it was held. When we thought here to move it forward, it was at a time when the Presidential Review Commission was underway, the Presidential Review Commission of state-owned companies, which is a comprehensive review of the landscape of state-owned companies, the intention of which was to rationalize the companies to make sure that the clarity as to why we are keeping the companies. Because some of them, you know, they evolve over time and so on, and they're not really strategic, they're not really useful. Some of them are strategic and so on. So allow us to get clarity, strategic clarity on state-owned companies, as it were. You need that, first of all, before you then can say, this will be the legal instrument that governs the company. Because the Presidential Review could pretty much have come back and say, actually, you know, the state has no business owning companies, so get rid of them, dispose of them, in which case there would be no need to legislation. So that step still needs clarity. But even with that, I think as far as the gap, this legal gap affects the effectiveness of our oversight of the department. We may still want to proceed, and that's the intention. We intend to table the legislation during the sitting of Parliament. This happened to be a very short year because of elections and so on. But I'm hoping that before the end of this financial year, we will have progressed to the point where we can table. Because the minister has to believe that the minister will table the act, it's important that the minister be familiar with the legislation. We have briefed her about it, but now it will be to take her through the detail of the act, and then she will then table it. And then, of course, it will be for you to engage with the bill, to shade it as you wish, to include or exclude whatever you think is important or not important in the bill, and then hopefully it will be passed in time. But I need to emphasize that there is a prior policy clarity that needs to be laid down with regard to what is the intent of the state with regard to ownership of companies, to what extent, with what institutional mechanisms for oversight. All of these things are covered in the Presidential Review, and we need to have finality of that review so that we can then clear the way for legislation and the HSMA Act. But let me hand over to my colleague, she will give the other questions.
Thank you, DG, and thank you to the committee members for questions and also comments. I think DG has articulated the issues on the bill. Maybe just an addition to that is that at the time of developing the bill, we were also mindful of the fact that we don't want to limit our role to just being purely governance. so and issues of performance. We went further to look into issues of possible funding mechanisms for trading companies. Because in the preamble of the bill, we acknowledged the fact that you want responsible trading companies that can rely on the strength of their own balance sheet, that can go out to the market for money. And we want to develop a program and a plan where they will wean themselves off relying on government. So the bill also talks to alternative funding mechanisms, it talks to partnerships with the private sector. And I think that I take DG's point and the member's point that we will engage through our parliamentary liaison officer that we come and with the committee on the bill. Then I will deal with three questions that relate to the same issue on the oversight role of the committee, as well as whether the department intends to bring the compacts to the committee for scrutiny. I think what we've done in the presentation, we've given an annex for the committee, because we've got eight state-owned companies, so we believe that they still got to be tabled in the annual report. We wanted to give the committee a feel of just what are the key performance areas that we look into, the indicators, and what then motivates those. However, one needs to caution that because they operate in different sector industries, you may find that some of the indicators will not apply to a particular state-owned company. And again, that's the issue of segment that the DG is talking about. The rationale why to date we have not been able to present full context to the committee is that there are restrictions on confidentiality and proprietary information of state-owned companies. Because some of the targets are aligned to contracts that state-owned companies conclude with other parties in the market. So we also wanted to act responsibly in the sense that we don't expose them, one, to unnecessary litigation or views. Secondly, we don't also expose their information, especially those that are in the competitive space, like your SAA and your SAX. So, but we will share the details of other state-owned companies in terms of their key performance areas and their indicators, and then how we set those targets. And then the question on why do we have delays in finalization of the compacts. It's both internal issues and external factors. Firstly, we also engage policy departments and national treasury in putting some of these packets together. So also that intergovernmental discussion tends to take a bit of time. But also the engagement internally at executive and official level, as I indicated, we find that they are not escalated seriously to the DG and the CE level. So that's why we've introduced now a 2-month period for the negotiations. Once we open negotiations, we need to close them in 2 months, and really which they need to escalate it to the DGs and the CE. But also, I think, in the nature of contracting, and especially where performance is, we know that now we link in performance to payment of incentives, particularly bonuses, and using, again, the reviewing of the salary adjustments. It's inevitable that you find pushbacks. So you find that in terms of negotiating particular targets, the little companies are not comfortable, and sometimes we officials, we push harder, and sometimes we become a little bit unreasonable to state-owned companies. So those kind of understanding their environment, them also understanding the space in which we operate, and also bringing in board government initiatives, those discussions tend to take long. But we believe that with the 2015, we've used the 2 months and it has worked. And I think today the DG, we only escalated twice. To you, so we try as well at our level that we do the best that we can to agree with the state companies. The question on non-payment of bonuses to lower level staff, while the executives the term that sometimes is, I see media likes using, they say it's criminal. we've introduced what we call the pyramid structure to be able to ensure that the executive remuneration is also aligned to the bargaining council discussions. So, for example, if bargaining negotiations with lower level staff is around 8%, we don't expect the executives to come and get 10% above. So that's how we try to level the playing field in terms of equity. Yes, yeah. And we again, as we said, we also bring the standards to the committee just to share the principles of the new remuneration standards. The question on the relationship between the department and the Department of Higher Education for Skills Development. We've introduced the skills development targets for state-owned companies in the context. And we are engaging, so we have engaged a number of occasions with the Department of Higher Education, and those discussions culminated in a number of memorandum of understanding with the Department of Higher Education on the state-owned companies partnering with the universities and also partnering with various training academies so that we are able, therefore, to assist in that space.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll come back on this one. In addition to what my colleague has said, we are targeting the National Skills Fund as a resource to help bolster skills development initiatives of state-owned companies. Because what has happened historically, state-owned companies used to be leading in the training of artisans and all kinds of professions. They used to lead and would train not only for themselves, but for the economy as a whole. However, when they succeed financial difficulties, the first area of cost cutting was in that space. With the result that when they start to invest in capital expansion, both Transnet and Eskom especially, they found that they didn't have sufficient skills. So now they're going back there. But their financial constraints are still limiting the extent to which they can, the numbers, as it were. And in that context, when we approached the Department of Higher Education and Training, and there's a partnership whereby, in the case of Transnet was able to take an additional 1,000 people, young people, into their training programs with the funding allocation. I think it was about 250 million rand that was assessed through to the National Skills Fund. So that's working very well. I'm sure as we go forward, other state-owned companies can also avail that resource. But the principle still remains that they have to train, they have to increase the intake of people into their training, and they have to train for more than themselves, as it were. So that is the problem that we are monitoring and we are connecting with them on. Thanks.
Thanks, Didi. There was also a question on the inability for the
President. Before we proceed, I'm just interested on the very same point we are raising now. Are this partnership with universities realized in the current year or the previous current financial? Because I was reading something here. The targets which were set by ESCO in relation to youth programs and the skills development, the artisans in particular, and what field engineering as well, they didn't reach the targets.
Yeah, no. I know there's been an issue with ESCO with regard to what is being measured. We have emphasized on an annual basis new intake. So the target we want to monitor is new intake. Whereas when ESCOM reports, they report on new intake and in the pipeline. What's in the pipeline? Because whenever these are multi-year programs, you know, 3 years or whatever. So they will report on what is in the pipeline and what the additional new intake that they're making. I think there was sort of a discrepancy between ourselves and ESCOM in regard to that, which we're bringing at so that we clarify. I'm sure that's what you're talking about. Because you'll find that our numbers and their numbers are that diverge, as it were.
The acknowledge that they didn't reach the target they set themselves, especially on youth programs. And the question will be, why would they set targets and not be able to? Or maybe it's the issue raised earlier on of 106 targets.
No, certainly. On youth as a special category, we must concede it's a new category. We didn't have a specific category called youth. So they're struggling with that. And so they have overestimated themselves in terms of what they can achieve. Because part of it is also to look at what capacity they're creating in the company to monitor this, to administer these programs, as it were, and what training those people is being given to those people so they can understand this landscape. I mean, it's got complexity, you know, as it were. So this is a new direction, and we'll keep pushing. But it may well be that in that regard they overshot in terms of targeting, in terms of what they can actually deliver.
Thanks, Didi. And I think all we have to add to that is in negotiating also with the Department of Higher Education, the fund that we got, or the amount that we got from the Skills Development Fund, it was said that it will not cater for the entire program for all state-owned companies. So the agreement was that the state-owned companies will also come to the party. And with the challenge that are facing, I think the part of the negotiations also was, where do we cut? And there are those targets that from the department will be deal-breakers. But there are also those that will be deal-breakers from their side, for example, keeping the life on, and vis-a-vis some of the targets on the CSI. And I think that's part also of aligning now our targets in terms of the number and the weighting of those targets. The question on the fact that the SOCs may not be accounting properly for their performance or are able to perform due to lack of competent personnel in the SOCs. I think what we have realized with the same companies, in particular ESCOMs and Transnet, was during the time when the department policy was still being clarified in respect of their role, there was a time when they were not building, there was a time when they were not engaging in investments. And that came with loss of critical skills in the company. Now, with the European Kusile and the market demand strategy on the Transnet, you see that now you're going out to get, and some of the skills did not only lose to the private sector, but they also lost internationally. So there are those challenges of the required skills, in particular with regard to ensuring implementation of the build programs, and hence the whole issue of settings, I guess, around skills development also, it is important. I think she has covered all the questions. Oh, there was just one on why the dashboard does not paint such a good picture if we monitor this quarterly reports that are being submitted by the same companies. And I think, again, the question is, at the time of monitoring, when there are new developments, you find that the state-owned companies will not be able to bring that information to the department timely. And by the time also when we raise the issues, you find that they are already into the next quarter, and the inconsistencies, the nature of the information that is being submitted to the department, although sometimes tends to be problematic, but also what we said to our little companies is that, like any other company in the private sector, If your job is to sit there and look at paper, companies will give you a lot of paper to keep you busy. It's the content and the substance of the reporting. But I think if you look at the dashboard really, you'll see that with three companies on AMBA, so you can see the progress, and the two that are really have achieved, and the three that are still challenged and are challenged because of really circumstances beyond their control. I think the quarterly reporting and the dashboard are giving us a sense that there is improvement in our monitoring, but we still have to do a lot. We acknowledge that. Thank you.
Because this picture changes
year. You know, so this year is like this, and there are special circumstances for that, and that. I mean, we're able to isolate non-performance due to factors that are beyond the company's control, and those factors that could have been controlled but were not controlled by the company, for which there needs to be consequences. And by the way, we are implementing denial of bonus based on performance outcomes. So where a company has not performed in accordance with we have a bill, we need to take a decision in regard to that. But I wanted to just say we need to recognize that this is a shift of a very recent shift in the exercise of shareholder oversight. This thing goes through different ways, as it were. There was a certain time, given the circumstances at that time, where the shareholder oversight posture was arm's length. Leave the companies to themselves and that type of thing. And there were very good reasons for that. To say, you know, they know best business, they know best market, let's let them do what they know best. But that model did not work as well, because this was a time where they built it up to their own devices, no alignment with government policies, abuse of the company and the resources of the company, and nepotism, and all of that. So we've been through an ugly issue in state ownership. What we're implementing now is a shift to say, no, this hands-off thing doesn't work. So we'll get closer, and we will enforce the compact, and we will monitor. And it has not been easy. So there's been pushback. Initially it was pushback. You know, and there's still pushback. But I think we've crossed the Rubicon, so to speak. I think we're in a period where the companies recognize that they have worked with government, and that's in their interest. Because especially when they start to encounter financial difficulties, then they realize that, oh, actually, we do need the shareholder. We do need government. And so there are a number of circumstances that are reinforcing this shift. We've spoken of active shareholder oversight, for example, where, if necessary, we will walk in and intervene if necessary. But for the rest, I think we are finding the right balance, and I'm satisfied that the trend is toward alignment. So this picture here will change. I wish I could see all green. As the DG of the department, totally. I wish I could only see all green. But I know that there are challenges, and some of them have to do with the performance of the economy, exogenous factors, as my colleague has indicated. There's one more question we should deal with, and then we'll finish this round of
The question related to best practice in oversight. It's a matter of fact, the GSM bill was underpinned by a global benchmark on trends in oversight that we did. We looked at how the Chinese model works with SASEC. We looked at the French model. We've looked at Temasek holding structure in Singapore. We've looked at Poland. We've looked also closer to home, Namibia, which have good legislation, but they still challenge in terms of implementation. And that actually made us also to decide on ensuring that you've got a clear policy environment and decision in terms of state ownership prior to introducing legislation that reaches that. Because you can have a legislation that isn't capable of being implemented if the policy is not right in terms of what the state wants to do with its little companies. And so in doing this global benchmark, we also recognize the fact that our model is so pragmatic in a sense that the DDE is not the only shareholder department in South Africa. The policy departments that also have a shareholder oversight role of other entities. So in developing the GSM, we wanted to create a blueprint for the entire government. However, being mindful that you don't want all the state-owned companies in DDE, what you say is that if the policy decision is to keep a decentralized institutional model, let's have a legislation that applies across, that makes sure that there's consistency in terms of how government manages this asset, despite putting all of them in one place. So we've done a number of comparisons, and again, the details we'll share when we bring the discussion with the bill to the committee.
Thank you very much. Let's take another round of questions if there are any. And there's Honorable Michael, we welcome you. And we would like to apologize to start before you arrive. Before we go to the next round of questions, you know, it has been always in my mind to say the shareholder obviously will have an interest when, for instance, Medupi didn't complete that project on time, which came with cost implications, and the initial figure was around 102 billion, is now over 200. And what matters, we know these companies are regulated by Companies Act. They operate independently. But as a shareholder, obviously we need to have mechanisms to see who is responsible to recoup the money which we spend because of the delays. Well, we understand there were industrial accidents and so on and so on. But honestly, that money is just too much, which to us says the project management plan, there was a problem around that. Because if it was only the issue of industrial actions, the amount would have been escalated to this level. So what are we doing in the department about this extra cost as taxpayers' money then? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, firstly, I apologize for being late. I trust that this Sunday is my apology. Please don't apologize for starting. I apologize for being late. It was just something out of my control. Chairperson, more an interaction with the department as to the way we work with DDE. So I think everyone knows that one of the banes of my life is the access to Medupi contract. And it was brought up when we had our meeting, when the minister was with us. It's been brought up in our portfolio committee. And this is something I need to engage with the department, because I am part of government and I'm part of the shareholder. And therefore, I think I have every right to interact and request this kind of thing. And I think the department needs to know certain things that are happening. Last year, when I requested these contracts, I got an email, a letter back from ESCOM. And They are petty things, but they build up to the point that it's unacceptable. For example, Chairperson, you will know, you and I are good friends, and I will call you by your first name and you will call me by my first name. But when we're in committee, we call each other Honourable Member, because that's what we do. And if I address something to you, I call you Mrs., and you will reply back to Mrs. Michael. So when I write to ESCOM, I write to Dear Mr. Madala or Dear Mr. Labrassi. And I did not expect to get a letter back saying, Dear Tasha, you are not my friend. You are not a member of my family. You are not a member of my political party. And I am a member of Parliament who has written a letter to you as a stakeholder. And I did not expect to get a letter back addressed to my first name. Not that I had the good courtesy of addressing you by your title. And I know this would sound petty in a normal situation, but let me continue and tell you why it actually irritates me. Because, Chair, you know, out of all 400 members of Parliament, the person who cares least about being called Honourable or Mrs. is me. And we joke about it regularly. And I regularly tell everyone in the committee to call me Tasha. But I do not expect, when I send a formal letter to ESCOM, to get a response, then dear Natasha. It's not acceptable. Because it shows a very little amount of respect being paid to someone. Chairperson, not only that, but being paid to the shadow minister. Someone that's been elected by 4 million South Africans. It's not on. Chair, I did come to committee where all of us enjoy the privilege of having open and frank discussions, which we have always done. And I mentioned the problem of these contracts. And I mentioned the fact that I requested these contracts and I've been, they've told me I will get partial access, and I've said partial access isn't enough, we all know I've said this. They also, one of the things that I've said is a problem, is that they will not provide me with contracts. I actually have to go to ESCOM and sit in a boardroom and wait for contracts to be given to me. That's essentially what ESCOM said, and that's my problem. So after the meeting that we had, which was, of course, a very good and frank discussion that we had with both ministers, and I enjoyed very frank and good relationship with Minister Brown, I'm very happy to say, as I did with Minister Igaba, I had a letter back from Colin Nagala telling me that it's sort of a very strange thing for him that I say that ESCOM won't give me the contract. And he referred me to the letter where I've been called Dear Natasha and says, there you go, what's your problem? Now, there is a problem because I've been granted partial access, so not full access, partial access, and also been told that they won't give me the contract, I have to go there.
Sorry, John, the point of order.
Here's the point of order.
I'm not sure we're still dealing with the presentation.
Yeah.
Can I be respected?
Let's allow him to proceed with the point of order.
Yes. I think we're dealing with the presentation. We're not here to listen to complaints of what happened in the ESCOM office and all of that. I think if the honourable member, if he has a problem with that, can that those issues outside the meeting so that we can actually proceed with the meeting. That's what I get from the honourable. She's complaining instead of engaging with the presentation at hand.
The order is noted. And then you also want to add to what you say?
Mr. President, also my apologies for coming late. I had to start another meeting. With regard to the point of order raised, I want to support that, the notion that we need to separate administrative issues and political issues. This is a political platform of which we cannot deal with the employees in the manner that the honourable member is doing. It is tantamount to taking advantage of us being conditioned. It can be correct. Whatever that has happened wrongly administratively, it should be addressed at that level. We can't expect the CEO of ESCOM to say anything about this because really he is at a disadvantaged position. I want to support the notion that let us deal with the issues as presented. If anything that is beyond this, it is dealt with in a particular and appropriate forum.
Thank you. I think Honourable Member Michael can proceed and focus on the presentation. The rest of the issues we'll discuss when the department is not in the committee.
Chairperson, thank you. The reason I raised it with the department is simply because I am here addressing the presentation. And if the members had read what I read in the presentation, we will see that we talk in the presentation about the oversight mechanism that we have as a shareholder, and that's what I'm bringing up, because it is my right to exercise oversight when I ask for contracts, and hence the reason I brought it up. And also this presentation deals with the way this committee interacts with the department, which is another reason I brought it up. But fair enough, let's just go straight on to the oversight, Chairperson. So what I'd like to know, Chair, while we have the department here and we're interacting with the outcomes and the mandates, etc. Chair, I agree with you 100% with regards to your question that you asked about the duty. But first, that Chairperson, what I'd really like to know from the department, in terms of when we do an analogy of the strategic plan that the department sets out and when the AG reports back to us on the strategic plans and when we see that targets haven't been met. In what way does this particular committee do we see going forward in the next 5 years? Will we interact with the committee directly to beat the public, the state-owned entities to report back to the committee, because obviously we understand that the DPE doesn't want to, well, you are basically the watchdog of the state-owned entities, but you also want to let them operate within their own mandate. So to what extent will this committee request DPE to step in and maybe sort of force the entities to come to Parliament, force the entities to come back to Parliament and do full report backs, that kind of thing? Because what I felt in the last Parliament was that the oversight that this committee did was hindered greatly by the fact that we would call SOEs to appear before us, and they wouldn't, or they would cancel. In actual fact, we very famously once refused to meet a state-owned entity that arrived here because only three people arrived and they weren't able to interact with correctly, and our chairperson sent them away and said that this is not the way you behave when you come to Parliament. So basically, why I mentioned what I did earlier about ESCOM was just as an example to bring me into the oversight. But to what extent can we count on the department to ensure that we exercise our oversight correctly by forcing state-owned entities to come and report back to us as committee? Thank you. Did you? Oh, Honourable Rando?
Chairperson, I take it that the Auditor General is auditing the state-owned companies. And the Auditor General usually raises issues from what he gets from any department that he is looking at that moment. What I want to ask from the department, if the Auditor General, DG, has raised some concerns, and then the SOC makes a turnaround strategy, but in making a turnaround strategy of them losing the focus that the AG has raised, what is the department's help to on that regard? Because I've come across many times on this person, you'll get a department with little AG raising this thing from a certain department. That department comes up with something that says they are going to correct what the AG has raised. But in the AG's next report, it goes back to a disclaimer on or an advert on the report of the department. What do you, as this department of public enterprise, do to such instances when you get such instances in your SO system? Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, and again we'll divide the responsibility to reply to the questions between myself and my DVC. I want to deal with the question that you asked, Chairperson, on would there be delays. First of all, let's deal with the cost overruns, the precise amount. To my knowledge, it has not reached the 200 billion rand mark, as if we're talking about the UP only. In fact, we have asked the company to tell us what is the actual number. It will be a moving target, because the cost overruns have to do with the claims arising from the contracts, because some of those contracts, SAP contracts, have non-performance penalties, which are of a monetary nature. But equally, ECOM also has the right to claim, and where the delays are due to non-performance by the contractors, and there are instances of that nature as well. So that number will shift all the time. So let me just say that, you know, I take note of the number that you referred to. We will try and pin down what the precise number is, so we can engage with you offline. But it's important to locate the multiple projects in a particular context, in a historical context. a lot of the challenges of the project have to do with the fact that as a country and ESCOM in particular, it has been a very, very, very long time since we did transition. To my recollection, I think the last power station was built in the 80s, in 1986. And the thing about the skills associated with projects of that nature is that when you're not doing them, those skills leave. Those skills leave, they go to markets where such projects are being undertaken. A lot of our skills we lost to the Middle East. Because in that time, the Middle East has been the region of the greatest increase in projects, construction projects, and so on. You know how things build the hotels and bridges, and so on. Now, when now ESCOM had to start, and you know they had to start on the back of the blackouts of 2008, in a hurry manner, with now, you know, in retrospect, very poor front end today, and having lost capacity, project management capacity within the company. So that is a fundamental context to understand what actually happened. And then they, ESCOM took this approach of owning the project in its entirety, with the subcontractors, as it were. The problem is managing the project alone. 32 different work packages, contracts. And having not the ability to project manage, that's always going to be a challenge. That's always going to be a challenge, as it were. Now, of course, there are, in retrospect again, issues as to whether, you know, in terms of the delays, the technical delays, whether the contracts should have gone to those companies and not those companies, that's all of history. We've learned our lessons. What is important is that some of those challenges have been overcome. On the labor front, for example, ESCOM has adopted the hands-off attitude that, you know, these are our workers, they are what's called the contractors and subcontractors. But those are contractors who are very unfamiliar with our labor relations dispensation, our industrial relations dispensation, and they enter into agreements and contracts with unions that actually, frankly speaking, were immutable. You know, so food like living conditions, and things like living conditions, quality of food, these were the issues that were causing the labor unrest that ought not to have been allowed to develop in the first instance. So a few things went wrong that have cost us very dearly. But fundamentally, I think because we had not done projects on this scale, this is a mega project in any language. And typically, you know, I did a course on infrastructure development. 90% of your projects are only 8. We have to start from that departure point and then say, how do you prevent that? How do we prevent the delays? I think in retrospect, we took things very lightly. We thought that once the project was launched, it will unfold smoothly. And our risk mitigations were not as robust as they ought to have been. And that's really the reason. And I think we've learned our lessons. I am hoping, because by the way, you're asking what do we do? Now, I think that the discussion of today essentially is about how do we overcome information asymmetry between the company and the shareholder. That's the challenge of ownership. Or ownership, because in the private sector, shareholders in the private sector, they have the same problem. How do you keep themselves informed fully? You know, now, of course, the Companies Act, you know, governs disclosures and that type of thing, but still, I think in the free owned sector, we have a particular challenge because, you know, some of our responses are not just robust and can be made and so on. But in that context, that problem manifested itself here in the Modul Department. Because as a department, we did not have an independent way of ascertaining whether the progress reports that we're getting are accurate. We didn't have. In fact, we discovered quite late in the day that a lot of information was not forthcoming. A lot of information was not. It was for that reason that we started to enforce much more greater accountability. We went to this system. We commissioned an independent consultant to go into the project, identify a lot of what I'm saying is the factors, the reasons why the delay come from our own independent assessment of the project. So the lesson is, when you're dealing with mega projects like this, as a shareholder, give yourself an independent ability to validate, to interrogate information that you're getting. But try and enforce as detailed disclosure by the company on what's happening as you possibly can. We have now agreed that whatever project monitoring tool that we use, that dashboard, we will have equal access. So we will also see, you know, the progress, and we can intervene early enough if we see that things are not going well. So a lot of that will be behind us. It's true that, we have no reason to doubt that the technical delays, the technical factors that cause the delay have been overcome. And ECOM has told us that they are on track to have the first unit commissioned by end of December this year. Which is assuming, I think, where we are vulnerable is in River Atlas. And there, we would really hope that the union leadership will appreciate how strategic, how critical, how vital it is for the sustainability of our country, the future of our country, that we get this project online. A lot of the issues of the workers' sustainability of their jobs in the wider economy depends on this project succeeding. And I would hope that there is nobody, as we speak, who does not have it in their interests that we achieve the milestone of seeing the project starting to come into our and sooner rather than later. We've already suffered extended delays in the project. We can't afford any further delays. And that's really the message that we as Jailor have communicated to ELCOM, and we will watch this like hawks, that's nothing that cannot be foreseen. Further delays or projects or challenges in any way whatsoever. My colleague will deal with the AGM. But before I do that, really sincerely apologize on the mic to the behavior that you described. It's not something that we are proud of, to have any of our companies, any of the officials of our companies, treat anybody, any member of the public in that manner. I would hope that you give us the facts and we can see that what we can do to intervene to prevent any further embarrassment by our companies of government. Because they are government, they have to subject themselves to protocols of government. Thank you.
Thanks, DG. I think your remarks on the DG, they also mirror the question that was asked on how do we as the department assist the state-owned companies to ensure that concerns or recommendations by the AG are taken into account in their plans and in their reporting. As I indicated in the presentation, that we have standing meetings between the chairpersons of the state-owned companies, the CEOs and the AG. But in addition to that, we have a standing meeting with the chairpersons of the Audit and Risk Committee, with the AG and Minister. Because one of the issues that we observed during the dashboarding monitoring is internal controls within state-owned companies. So bringing in AG assisted so that they can also be able to understand how AG will be looking at the bigger picture. And also the fact that because the state-owned companies, they also contract private auditors, then the AG is able to come in and bring a much sharper government focused monitoring on state-owned companies. And we believe that at the end of the day, the department's performance cannot be isolated from its portfolio. And so it's for that reason that we requested AG to intervene. As a matter of fact, AG is auditing two of our state-owned companies because we realized that the way we challenge the needed the understanding of government processes. And I think, again, what we do is that we are only challenged in terms of our intervention, and again, that's where the GSM will be able to help. Because most of the time, we get asked, is your intervention or interference? And because, as DG said, this view of the past of arm's length relationship. So when the department comes closer, we are criticized, not only by our own state-owned companies, but by the public as well, that the department now wants to be in the operations of the state-owned companies. But the further you are from the SOC, the more difficult it becomes for you to know of their challenges. So we find ourselves also in a difficult space. And however, we need to repeat, one of the major interventions on the whole issue of labor, because Minister was also worried about that if you allow this unrest to continue and hope that the company is dealing with it, we also have to account to the department. And part of the engagement was Minister to facilitate a discussion with all the affected unions, the contractors, and the ECOM. And that culminated into a project labor agreement with a serious commitment made by all the parties in terms of supporting and ensuring that we do this development time. And I think that was a strategic intervention by the department in order to assist the SOCs. And we further directed the ESCOM that they need to trigger the penalty and the performance clauses in the contract. Something that in state-owned companies, you find that it's not done. They will contract, the losses will be there, but they take forever to negotiate and trigger those. And for the first time, just do it. And they did that, and as they said, because we said it is there to protect you and to manage your risk. So I think that's part of the government intervention to make sure that they assist the SOC when they are challenged.
Thank you very much. I think we exhausted all the issues, unless it's a matter of life and death from members who would like to raise something. Honorable Sadie?
Yeah. Yeah, just two quick follow-ups. I'm asking myself on the tool that you're using to determine if non-performance is not out of the making of an agency, to be able to say you did not meet this target, but you it was beyond your control. I'm interested in that tool that you're able to use. Because obviously, a company will always have reasons why they did not meet the target as designed. So I'm interested in that one, because it's an issue that keeps on coming. And then the last one is on the bill vis-à-vis the Presidential Review Commission. The work that is being done at the level of the Review Commission, and then vis-à-vis the bill. I'm trying to ask myself if at the stage, you might not have a situation where you are able to move very fast, very far, and be forced to come back on the basis of what the review, the outcome of the review, by the Presidential Review Commission is saying, in relation to the bill. Just plan to move to the last issue. The last one, isn't that we are in the process of the bill, and we are also awaiting the outcome of the review commission, the Presidential Review Commission, in relation to the operations of the SOC in general. And I'm saying, in the process, are we not able to come to a situation where the final design of the bill is not necessarily or contradicts what the commission outcomes is, related to how the opposition is supposed to operate. Yes, thanks.
Let me start with the last question, because the report is out. And in fact, the report supports the bill. The report supports the legislation. But there are other things which we take into account in terms of, for example, how much wider do we want to own? The numbers were going to the 700 of state-owned companies. And surely not all of them could be strategic. Some are at provincial level, local level. Someone actually described this as the agentification of the state, where instead of building capacity within the state, you set up all kinds of organizations and you complicate the governance as it were, because once they're outside, control issues, governance, and so on, sort of things we're talking about, become very amplified, as it were. And so it's, all is not well on that front. And I think that report acknowledges that, proposes what could be done, proposes the criteria for what is strategic, what could be disposed, and that type of thing. But we must engage with all of that. We must engage with all of that. So I think what we need to the department and committee we need to decide on is, insofar as the finalization and agreement on the recommendation is yet to be achieved, what are the risks of proceeding? We've got to make that assessment. What are the risks of proceeding with the legislation whilst all of these other things are not tied down, as it were. But also, charge that in relation to the state of law, because the state of law is also not really optimal. How much longer can we stay in this sort of situation, that undermines, the effectiveness of the oversight, as it were. For example, on issues of funding, funding for those companies that are in distress, it is such a difficult thing. It is so difficult. And by the time you come to an agreement, the problem has become much bigger than it was. Because the Treasury are not sure how to respond. They have their own constraints. We're sitting with the companies and there's no guidance in law as to what you do. There's no guidance in law. So I'm going to sit with this situation, for how long? So the things that are pressing us, trying to find some way of framing these in providing guidance and type of thing. Maybe we could even say, if certain things are not in place, if we don't achieve certain things in certain time, then, dispose. Or something like that, find another investor or something like that, There's no guidance about how we deal with all of those issues at the moment. So, something, what is the risk of proceeding to try to address that, given that there is no finality, if you like, on the recommendations of the PRC report. And I do suggest that the committee engages with the report. I'm sure there is those people in the presidency that are responsible for the report that will be able to come and engage with the committee on the report and the recommendations. And they probably have a better sense of how we will proceed with that work going forward. The other question was on I'll give you an easy example. So we will contract with SAA with regard to profitability. At the time we contract, there are two things which will determine the profitability that are typically will land us in that situation. In fact, if you see with SAA, the targets are very interlinked.
is that if the exchange rate goes the wrong way, it affects the passenger numbers, it affects revenue, it's going to ultimately affect profitability. And they have no control of the exchange rate. The other one is the price of fuel. If the oil price goes the wrong way, it affects the price of jet fuel, it affects their cost structure. It could actually be paid in cash, literally be paid in cash, especially on the long-haul flights, you know. So in those circumstances, what do you say? What do you say? Anyway, I think the point is made. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are running out of time because we still have to go through the minute numbers. Let's release the department, but before we release them, the committee would like to be updated on the issues of the broadband in Franco, the processes, so that we are better placed to understand the process.
No, we will take note of that, and we will arrange an appropriate moment to come and talk to you about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It has been a very informative session. We really appreciate all the information given to us. It will equip us to further do our oversight role and also to give input where we could as Parliament. You are released and thank you very much.
PMG? Is this on? Hello? Is this yours?
Yes. Well, but I don't need it.
Oh,
okay.
On our agenda, we are now going to deal with consideration and adoption of minutes. And I guess this will be the minutes of the 9th of July, 2014. Can you go to page 1? Page 2? We are giving consideration which will include corrections, both grammar and content. Before we adopt, we consider these minutes before we go for adoption. We are on page 2, Honourable Members. Yes, Honourable Rancho. American, yes. The last page is page 3 on November. Anything on page 3? If there's nothing, we can move for the adoption. Any mover? Honorable Rancho has already moved for the adoption and seconder. Honorable Marais, then we are done with the minutes of the 9th of July 2014. We will now request the Secretary of the Committee to take us through the training which we are planning to have it next week.
Thank you, Honorable Member. We have given you two documents. One is a program and the other one is a training program line. With the help of the Continent Advisor and the Professor, these are the issues that we have identified to take members through during the training program. But the intended first day is over 2 days. But now due to the issue of that members attend all the other protocol committees and we don't want to interfere with their other meetings, Now we have decided to have the meeting at home, so it's only one day, next week Wednesday. Now, in terms of the program, we have only looked at issues that are going to assist us in terms of the processing of annual reports that we'll be doing from the week of next, we'll be processing annual reports. And according to the program, we have a presentation on understanding of state-owned companies. And then this outline will actually highlight just what exactly is it that that particular presentation would cover. And then we have the governance framework for state-owned companies and national treasury. And then we'll also have the Union of Annual Report as an oversight tool. It will be done by the Auditor General. And also this is only because at 2 o'clock we have a plenary in Parliament. So what can ensure that this is not in the clock, we are able to cover as much as possible. And we will have another capacity building program sometime later in the term to see whether we can use another 2 days or so. And then we cover the other parts of the program.
Thanks very much, the Secretary. They the proposed programming for the training. If there's any member who's not comfortable with the days or the content, we can be raised so that we do amendment to the program itself. Agreed. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of our meeting. Thank you very much. We'll meet next week when we do the training. Honourable Mary, you want to say something?
Thank you. Yes, and I just remind the Secretary about the minutes of the joint committee meeting had with Energy when each one was there.
The minutes are ready, Secretary?
Yes, you gather some time to us.
Thank you. Please, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.